Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Center for Poets and Writers Celebration of Books gets underway tonight and all day tomorrow at OSU Tulsa. My guests today are two global ecologists who are working to publicize conservation efforts ranging from the forests of Madagascar to the urban wilds of New York's Central Park. Michael Tobias and Jane Morrison are the husband and wife, filmmakers, authors, and principals of the Dancing Star Foundation. They'll be participating in several panels and signing their books tomorrow during the celebration, as well as a special showing of their latest documentary, Hotspots, which will be shown tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Circle Cinema. Hotspots focus on isolated areas of wild places around the world with incredible biodiversity and large numbers of threatened animals and plant species endemic to those areas. In addition, Tobias and Morrison are the author of a beautiful book of natural areas titled Sanctuary, Global Oasis of Innocence, focusing on wildlife areas as well as special sanctuaries set aside for species or groups of species. In addition, Tobias has a new novel out titled Chateau Beyond Time. Both of those books are published by Cantaloupe Books here in Tulsa. They're our guests today on Studio Tulsa as they talk about their work around the world. Michael and Jane, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
As part of the celebration of books, you'll be participating in several panels about some of your new books, which are coming out, but also you'll be showing your documentary film Hotspots. And one of the books and Hotspots have really followed something you've really made your life's work, which is really documenting these last places on Earth that are really, truly wild, that are housing special species of plant and animal life. And that's really what your work has been about, has it not?
Oh, absolutely. We're really focused more than ever on biodiversity and why it matters to the human species, to the human condition, to the planet, and what's happening to it. What's at risk? What can we do to affect a positive outcome for species and evolution in general, if you will?
Mm-hmm. Now, you've been made this your life work. How have things changed in the time you've been documenting these places around the world? I mean, we've lost more places from when you started. Is there a greater sensitivity worldwide about these issues than, say, when you first started?
I think there's much more consciousness globally, and I think that people are more attached to those things which are already gone. Of course, they see the things are gone, but also to those familiar sites that they know they may lose.
Mm-hmm.
What would happen, for instance, if we didn't hear those birds singing? If we miss the sight of a squirrel eating a nut in the tree or on our grass, however annoying it might be, this world would be a sad place as far as I'm concerned.
And of course, while that awareness is up, you still have the economic sort of loggerheads between conservation and people in poverty using slash and burn techniques or just trying to make a living or using the land in a way for subsistence.
Well, this is certainly one of the huge...
Or exploitation, I should say.
Yeah, this is an enormous challenge for policy makers within the conservation arena. And you can translate it into a very basic equation, which suggests that there's roughly 400 million people on the planet who live within 10 kilometers of some of the most at-risk habitat regions on Earth. And these hundreds of millions of people tend to be economically marginalized. They tend to, as you use the phrase slash and burn, exploit the natural resources for subsistence levels. The other nearly 6.2 billion of us on this earth are deriving some benefit, oftentimes indirect pharmaceutical or certainly agricultural benefits from those same regions. So the pressure to bear on the aggregates of rare species and even those basic flowering plant type species that are significant in terms of nature's free services, the watersheds, the cleansing of soils and of air, all of which we depend on globally, are being attacked. And not just by greed, not just by economic profiteering, but by subsistence level. So this poses a poignant challenge indeed for conservation.
Let's talk about the film Hotspots, which you'll have a showing Saturday night at 7 at the Circle Cinema. You're following the International Conservation...
Conservation International, President,
President
Russell Mittermeier, yeah.
And around as he visits various, what he calls hotspots. First mm-hmm. of all, what's a hotspot?
Well, a hotspot is a place on the planet that has a high level of endemic species at risk of extinction.
Species found nowhere else.
Mm-hmm. So when you say endemic, it means it only shows up in this rainforest, it shows up in this river basin, in this mountain range.
We the words can get a little strange. You can use indigenous or native, but that doesn't necessarily connote endemic. Endemic means it's not only native to a place, it exists nowhere else. It's not native in any other place. So that's a very key definition. A hotspot's defined as a place that contains at least 1,500 endemic flowering plants that are at least 70% gone already. So in other words, you've got the highest level of biodiversity stacked up in a tiny area that's under dire threat. And there's 35 such terrestrial hotspots on the planet. And we took representative selections, if you will, including Chile's Easter Island, including parts of Brazil, parts of Peru, parts of the United States, parts of New Zealand, and parts of Madagascar, as representative iconic places at risk that are truly pivotal in terms of our understanding of what can be done to save these places. So it's really it's an optimistic film, actually.
Yeah, and you show some really interesting cooperation between locals and conservationists. But the film opens actually on Easter Island, and this is sort of the example of what could happen. Because I guess Easter Island at one point was covered in forests, it had incredible biodiversity, and yet when you see it now, it's a windswept grassland now with basically these huge totems that they're famous for. And as you're shooting, there's this wonderful image that kind of shows the problem of all of these spaces. You know, you're out here and you look like you're, you know, 1,000 miles from anywhere on this island. He's doing a stand-up and here comes a car right behind you. And it's you know, man.
Yes. Yeah.
It looked like it was an outtake, and you go, wow, this makes sense to use this.
It was an outtake. That was a style in the film that viewers will, I hope, enjoy. We deliberately put in behind the scenes footage throughout, and we've had some interesting comments about that. You brought up the very first one, which gets a lot of giggles, but it's a poignant giggle to be sure, because you realize, oh my gosh,
this is the problem.
Yeah. And we just had a screening of this film, a premiere in Europe of Hotspots at the United Nations Environmental Program, UNEP, and one of the comments by some of the great scientists on the planet who were watching this was that, my goodness, there's been a lot of wildlife films, but very few films that have tackled the real life in the trenches warfare, if you will, that's involved in saving these places, the battles of conservation. And this is an unanesthetized, real portrait of what it takes to save a rare primate, a rare insect in a national park that's already protected but is still at risk, what it takes to save rare plants or rare parrots or a rare pocket mouse at a marine base in Southern California. This is the rarest mammal in North America. It weighs all of a few grams. It's the size of your thumbnail. There's only probably 100, 150 left, and the Marines, the same Marines being trained to go to Iraq, are protecting by congressional mandate this tiny little nocturnal mouse. He's Mighty Mouse as far as we're concerned.
And this is what's also interesting is we think of, when you talk about these sanctuaries and these hotspots, we think of them being in exotic locales, and in fact, you're within the lights of L.A., you know, that's the other interesting thing I think about this film. This is not necessarily about far-flung, away from civilization places. These are places where man is wherever they are, and here in the developed world as well.
Well, you asked a question initially, Rich, which was, what changes have we seen over the years? And Jane referenced the raising of consciousness, to be sure. But one thing I'd really like to point out for your listeners is the fact that 15 years ago, the human population explosion, if you will, was producing something like 93, 94 million newborns every year. That's taking account of mortality, because about 150 million were being born. We have child and infant mortality, yeah, and so on. And we were adding a Los Angeles about every 2.5 weeks to the planet. While we've lowered that fertility a little bit by about 8-9%, but we're still adding to the world something like 80-82 million people a year. All of these individuals are precious. All of them are going to require a standard of living, healthcare, education, everything we all want. So the consumerism that's driving an ongoing population explosion in this country, not this is not just India or China or sub-Saharan Africa. The U.S. Census data indicates the United States could hit 500 million people in another century, all of whom are going to demand and expect a standard of living. Well, this is not good news for biodiversity because they don't get bailouts by Congress. They don't get any kind of assistance from banks or international organizations. What they get is what we dole out to them. So
the space we leave them.
That's right. Yeah. And the quality of that habitat, unfragmented, if it exists in very many places at all on the planet, which it really doesn't. Most of the sanctuaries that we've portrayed in our work are fragmented areas. Not all of them, but most of them. So we're really up against it. And this generation must recognize the peril at which we've placed the rest of the creation and do everything in our power to help.
My guest today is Michael Tobias, a global ecologist, author, and filmmaker, and his wife, who's also a filmmaker and author, Jane Morrison, who worked together on global ecology. Their documentary Hotspots shows tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Circle Cinema as part of the Center for Poets and Writers Celebration of Books, and they'll also be talking about several of their latest books as well at the conference tomorrow, and they're our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, the film is very optimistic, as you said. Let's take one of the first areas you survey, which is Madagascar, which, of course, has incredible biodiversity and has a lot of species that are particular to it itself because it's been so isolated, you know, broke off from Africa, and it just sort of developed its own species through evolution. There you're looking for lemurs and some specific species of lemurs. But what really is exciting about this is how these conservation organizations are working with local populations so that they have a benefit from being guides and understanding the value of having these species there and areas of terrain for that species to roam. I think that's probably the best takeaway from that.
Well, what we see there is how important it is to engage the locals, to have local people have an investment in ecology, in learning about the species who dwell in their own backyard, and they are the leaders in ecotourism. For instance, in one region of Madagascar that we visited, the local people whose antecedents practice slash and burn agriculture have taught themselves languages, have learned the not only the local common names, the Latin names for the species present, the names in all of the languages in which they're leading and guiding tourists, and they really have become the greatest proponents for conservation in their own region. Mm-hmm. And it's quite fascinating to see people whose parents and grandparents may have been reviled for changing their lifestyle and adopting these practices have tremendous success. They have the support of international, they have the support of government, they have the support of international NGOs, and they are models of what people can do, how people can learn, people with no education, people who are struggling to make a living, and have a success. So it's a win-win for the indigenous tribal peoples. It is, of course, a boon to the wildlife that is there, that is found nowhere else, and that elsewhere still in Madagascar is hunted for food.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting, you know, as I was watching the film, you kept seeing this show up time and time again where locals are taking that role. But I was also struck by the fact that the NGOs that are working in this area, they're from Europe. You know, they're not Madagascars working in that NGO at the level of doing the science, of doing the, you know, that's the next step to me is where in the Brazilian rainforest, it's Brazilians running that operation, and you know, it's not German scientists or French scientists coming down to do that teaching, that the teaching's happening within the land. And I was really struck by that as I was watching the film.
Well, actually, in the Madagascar film, there are some PhD Malagasy scientists in that film. And the scientific community, whether it's physics or ecology or mathematics or engineering, are collaborative in a big way. There's over 300 major NGOs working to save the Brazilian rainforest, who are Brazilian. The international support is critical because, to date, more money has flowed from the coffers of the European Union, North America.
That's where the money is.
Where the money is. Mm-hmm. But there's no. You're absolutely right, Rich. The long-term success of any conservation endeavor will absolutely depend upon local individuals, infrastructure, developing conservation capacity to educate young people to get graduate degrees or to expand their intuitive base upon which they've grown up and understand local flora and fauna and maximize and optimize those talents. Any scientist who comes from abroad into a new forest, whether it's in New Guinea, in China, in Brazil, first thing they do if they know what they're doing is to ask the local chief or the local herbalist, what's that? The species are so diverse now that anyone who would presume otherwise is a fool. I mean, let's face it, until the last decade, the common assumption amongst systemologists, those are individuals within the biological sciences who literally count the taxonomic variations on the earth, all the different plants, animals, insects, spiders, etc. The number was about 1.6 to 1.8 million creatures that had been inventoried, and the vast majority of those were nothing more than 3x5 file cards in a dusty archive with a name in Latin, a binomial, you know, Homo sapiens being one of them. Yeah. All right. Now, 10 years, 15 years later, the best guesstimate is that there are at least 100 million species on the planet. 85% of them are arthropods, spiders, insects, but 100 million species. So we know, at best, 1.5 to 2% of life on Earth. We're beginners. And at the very moment that we're recognizing how much we don't know and how rich this planet is, tragically, we're losing it. So that's the provocative challenge. And so to go into a rainforest is to go into a place where one tree may contain 50,000 endemic insects that live nowhere else. And this was the case that occurred in eastern Ecuador in 1998 when two gentlemen from the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, entomologists studying insects, invertebrates, went to a national park, Yeswana, in eastern Ecuador. And in one tree, extrapolated from their data that there must be 50 to 60,000 different species of insect inhabiting that tree. You cut down that one tree, you've just lost 60,000 species. And we also know that for every one of those species, there's codependence. There's other unseen species that we haven't yet ascertained. So when we hear about these sort of almost cliche-like destructive things going on, you know, the loss of 5 acres of rainforest every second or every minute, what we're talking about is an unimaginable loss of species. So it's an unbelievable situation we're in.
Let's segue from hotspots or this film where you're really telling, for the most part, success stories, although you see the dangers, like the rainforest. You don't pick the Amazon rainforest. You pick the other rainforest where Rio de Janeiro is. It's on the Atlantic coast.
The Mata Atlantica.
Yeah, the Mata Atlantica. And you see the forces of, you know, a sugar cane plantation next there. They're doing some burning. It moves slightly over into the rainforest, and it's like you can't control it. And you see that these decisions are there. But I do want to switch from hotspots to your other book, which sort of follows up on that, and that's Sanctuary, which it's a very, very beautiful book, beautifully photographed book. But it's looking at more of these places of just great biodiversity. And can you maybe talk about some of the places you chose and why you chose them?
Well, we celebrate really precious, beautiful, outstanding, and unusual sanctuaries in this book. Some of them are urban sanctuaries. Some of them are places you wouldn't necessarily expect that we might have chosen, for instance, Central Park in New York City.
Yes, right. Yeah, no, that was really great because you saw this juxtaposition of people and nature sort of, and the diversity of the park is amazing. You just do bird species, and just the amazing variety of bird species in Central Park was sort of eye-opening to me.
Over 270 that have been identified, yeah.
Seeing raccoons in the daytime, seeing raccoon mothers with their young, it was fabulous. The richness of the interaction of humans and wildlife in Central Park was something really beautiful to behold.
Mm-hmm. Well, the book was a challenge in that you've got in sanctuary approximately 20 global sanctuaries that are profiled in about as many countries. And we selected them from a list of over 114,000 refuges on the planet, which includes refuges, 10 refuges in the state of Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. There's great bioregions in Oklahoma. So Oklahoma didn't make it into the book, but the only states that did in the United States were New York and Alaska. It was really a tough choice, but we chose places in Europe, the old forests of Poland, the Iberian Wolf Sanctuary in Portugal, Brigitte Bardot's sanctuary in France.
Which is actually a domestic animal sanctuary, which I thought was a really interesting choice.
Well, the reason for that is that part of our work, Jane's and my work, and those of all of our colleagues at Dancing Star Foundation and in many parts of the world, is to push this reconciliation, if you will, between the natural sciences and animal rights. And this has been a division, if you will, of activists and proponents who have focused on different things. But it's our contention that a rare kakapo, which is a flightless alpine parrot of which 91 exist in New Zealand, it's one of the rarest parrots in the world, millions of dollars, vast amounts of attention and scientific due diligence are lavished upon this magnificent bird. There's very little difference in our minds between a rare parrot and a chicken that ends up between two slices of bread. So this book is really trying to sensitize people to the reality of the preciousness of all life without any kind of segregation between a rare parrot or a common chicken. We're trying to remind people that life is precious. And just because there may be millions of birds flocking in the skies, that doesn't mean that they can't go extinct the way the passenger pigeon did. And so our sanctuaries in this book from Namibia and southern Yemen and South India and Japan, moss gardens in Japan, to orangutans in Borneo, to some of the rarest birds in the world and snakes in Suriname, to Central Park, to Mount Wrangell St. Elias National Park, the biggest preserved area in North America, one of the largest in the world, in which there's a tiny little seabird that's in desperate straits because of global warming. All of these enter into this converging sensibility of protecting life.
And that's the next step, too. I was taken by the fact that you opened with Wrangell National Park and this small little seabird that's in danger there, because a lot of efforts focus on the big, huge end of the food chain sort of mega fauna, and not so much on little seabirds. And here it is. This is probably one of the world's wildest national parks. Oh, yeah. It's an incredible place. And there is megafauna there. And you focus on this little seabird.
The Kittlitz murrelet.
Yeah.
First identified in the mid-19th century. It's in the Alcidae family, which relates it to puffins. And it's sort of like the North American equivalent, if you will, to a penguin. It's one of our most tenacious little birds. They exist in Siberia, in the Aleutians, and in four study areas in southeastern Alaska, one of which we had the honor to take part in with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife and the National Park Service. And it's a mystery. This is one of those instances where you've got Mount St. Elias, it's like Mount Everest falling into the Gulf of Alaska, 18,000 vertical feet of ice. And on the slopes of this enormous peak, after which the national park is named, you've got this little bird who nests up on the cliffs, flies 25 miles out to sea, socializes with other kitlet murrelets to find various types of fish species, flies back to its nest. We were able to record one of the first births. The problem is the tidewater glaciers, the glaciers that flow into the Gulf of Alaska, the Pacific, are receding. When John Muir was there over 100 years ago, the glaciers were 25 miles out further to sea. So what's happened is, as the glaciers recede, the birds who nest on those glaciers have to fly further and further out toward the water to find their fish. As the water warms up, the fish species are receding also. They have to go further and further afield. They're leaving their chicks more and more exposed. And what's happened is, as the ice, as the glaciers recede, in an all too familiar scenario now with climate change, opportunistic tree species start taking over those now ice-free areas, and golden eagles nest in the trees. Golden eagles start preying on the chicks while the parents are out at sea looking for ever-receding food.
Yeah, while they're taking a longer, their commute gets bigger.
Commute gets bigger, and suddenly new predators that in millions of years were never on these glaciers are moving in. This is a problem that may be out of our hands.
Yeah. And of course, you know, when you think of the golden eagle, you think, oh, well, this is a species that's in danger. We need to protect it.
It's threatened in Oklahoma.
Yeah, but it's also wreaking its own environmental damage, or is this just all evolution?
Well, that almost gets into a theological debate.
It's accelerated evolution.
Yeah.
Highly accelerated, perhaps by definition, unnaturally accelerated.
No question about it.
Yeah.
Look,
thanks to us.
Yeah. I mean, let's not forget that there are, as of May of this year, when signatories to the Convention on Biological Diversity for the United Nations convened in Bonn, Germany to examine the plight of biodiversity loss worldwide, they came out and it was picked up by all the wire services with a decree, a consensual decree by the scientific communities of the world, which said, hey, folks, we now understand that we are losing species at a rate at least 25,000 times faster than the natural background rate. This is headline news. This is the biggest wake-up call this generation is probably ever going to hear. And we've got to deal with it. We have got to confront it head-on, and it requires not just solid economic times, but solid consensus on what matters most and what kind of legacy we're going to pass to our children and our grandchildren, which is hopefully, from what we're saying and doing in our life, a reverence for life itself.
The name of the film is Hot Spots, their latest documentary, and then Sanctuary is their book, A Global Oasis of Innocence, published by Council Oak Books. We just have a moment or two later. I know you also have a brand new novel out, Michael. It's Chateau Beyond Time. Tell us a little bit about the novel.
Council Oak Books here in Tulsa also published it, Laura Wood being the editor. Great editor. I wouldn't want any better editor. What would happen if you discovered that the Garden of Eden actually exists in the 21st century, hidden away in the heart of Europe? To what lengths would you go to protect it? That's the fundamental premise of this thriller.
All right. Well, I hope a lot of people pick that up as well. You can talk to Michael and Jane about their books and about their films at the Celebration of Books this weekend. And I hope a lot of people come out to the screening tomorrow night at 7 at the Circle.
Thank you, Rich.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks,
Rich.
We appreciate
it.
Delightful to meet you.
Michael Tobias and Jane Morrison speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. The global ecologists, authors, and filmmakers will be participating in the Center for Poets and Writers Celebration of Books, which gets underway tonight and also tomorrow at OSU Tulsa. Their documentary Hotspots will be shown tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Circle Cinema. They're also the co-authors of Sanctuary, Global Oases of Innocence. And Michael Tobias also has the novel Chateau Beyond Time. Both are published by Council Oak Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory, production assistance by Rebecca Higgins. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.